Our forum speaker this morning is Dr. Elliot Butler, professor and chairman of chemistry at BYU. Dr. Butler received his undergraduate and graduate degrees, including PhD, from the California Institute of Technology, where he also did postgraduate work and was an A.A. Noyes Fellow. He joined the BYU faculty in 1956. He has published a textbook and a dozen papers in professional chemistry journals. Not bound to the literature of his own discipline, Dr. Butler is a voracious reader in the humanities, arts, history, biography, and such literary journals as Saturday Review. Furniture making and photography are active hobbies. The Butler family members are all backpackers. Their trips have ranged from a week spent in the Grand Canyon to a 9-day, 75-mile hike around Mount Rainier. Dr. Butler has made significant contributions to the university community through the Faculty Advisory Council, of which he is presently chairman, the Library Planning Committee, the Pre-Medical Committee, and as chairman of the Faculty Academy, an informal organization of classes and seminars taught by faculty members for their fellow faculty members. In 1974, Dr. Butler received the Carl G. Mazur Award for teaching excellence. Graduate students he has supervised include 4 master's degree recipients and 7 doctoral students. When BYU branches were wards, back in the good old days, Brother Butler served as bishop of the 11th BYU ward. He now teaches the gospel doctrine class in the Edgemont 8th ward. Sister Ann Butler, who is with her husband on the stand today, is welcome to our forum assembly most cordially. They are the parents of 4 children, all of whom have either graduated from, have attended, or are now attending BYU. The spouses of 3 married children are all BYU graduates. Professor Butler's topic today is derived from the Mark Twain epigram, "Everybody is ignorant, only on different subjects." Professor Elliot Butler.
It is presumptuous, of course, to attempt to describe and discuss the educated person. I take comfort, however, in the observation that one is not required to be that he describes. It does seem easier to get directly at the opposite of some of these matters. James Thurber had a classmate whom he described clearly. While he was not dumber than an ox, Thurber said, he wasn't any smarter either. I guess all of us who have taught have known that boy. In my attempt to reach a definition of the educated person, I've kept you and me in mind. If the standard set by the definition is so high that almost none among us can reach it, then the standard is clearly too high and there is no point in discussing it, except as an academic exercise. One is tempted to consider as educated only Renaissance men, those great scholars whose knowledge and superior ability swept across many fields. There's no doubt that Leonardo was an educated man. And one stands in awe of Christopher Wren, who was mathematician and astronomer and seemed to have picked up architecture only as an afterthought, and then designed beautiful churches, cathedrals, libraries, hospitals by the score. Thomas Jefferson's breadth of excellence was such that at a dinner in the White House honoring Nobel Prize winners, President Kennedy could describe his guests, those Nobel laureates, as, and I quote, "the most extraordinary collection of talent, of human knowledge, that has ever been gathered together at the White House," with the possible exception of when Thomas Jefferson dined alone. But let's face the truth. Renaissance people are not crowding the world. Even solid competence in a rather narrow field is not common enough. On the other hand, if the standard for the educated person is so low that with little or no effort anyone among us can achieve it, it's a valueless standard. A common fault made in discussing education is to describe it as a posture or stance, when in fact it is, as Benjamin Franklin defined freedom, a dynamic and ongoing obligation. The vigor and effectiveness of one's mental activity and learning today tell much more concerning whether that person is educated than does the record of matters learned last year. Yet we use commonly such expressions as, she was educated at Vassar. He completed his education last year. Or even at times, I'll be so glad to finish my education and get out of here. It is sad to tell that too often those statements about finishing and completing one's education turn out to be true. Let us try then. An educated person is one who, by his or her own initiative and discipline, is consciously, vigorously, and continuingly learning. An educated person is one who, by his or her own initiative and discipline, is continuously, vigorously, and continuingly learning. We'll need to add two small corollaries later, but for now, let's not cloud the issue. Meeting this definition does not guarantee one a Nobel Prize, nor does it make one a scholar. But it is worth noting that no one has ever become a scholar without first becoming an educated person. This is a good first step. Notice some characteristics that the educated person must have. If she is educated, she is learning now, and this learning is not an aberration, because the requirement is that it be a continuing process. If he is educated, the learning must be the result of self-discipline and not the result of demands and pressures from his parents or society. If she is educated, she is learning vigorously. I've enjoyed the experience in almost every one of 20 years at Brigham Young University of teaching a class of freshmen. And every day except this morning at 8, I enjoyed that experience this time. I was nervous this morning. Without exception, there have been a few educated people in every freshman class that I have taught. There have been men and women who had grown out of the slave-like position of doing only what was required by pressures from parents or teachers or society, and had found the satisfaction of being free, of doing more than meeting requirements, of learning because it is good to learn. It is disappointing to report that there have also almost invariably been a few who had chosen a false freedom, the hedonistic freedom of doing only that seemed fun at the moment. This, of course, is no freedom at all. It leads neither to education or even to graduation. A much larger number of students work to meet the requirements. It's commendable to do what is required, but only meeting the requirements can at best make one trained or taught, never educated. A first corollary to our definition of the educated person, that the learning be worthy of the attention of a human being. To say that we seek all truth is, I believe, a foolish statement. I believe that we had better seek truth that is of some value. The verb to learn is used in so many ways that we must spend a moment to clarify what we're about. The most common and casual use of the word is completely removed from the conscious and active learning of the educated person. One says, I just learned that it is raining in Santa Quinn. Or asked, have you learned at what time the play begins? To become aware is often important, and it may be truth that one is becoming aware of, but that is not the learning that makes one educated. The learning must be active. There is a kind of very real learning that occurs as a result of facing life, but this too is not the active learning required by our definition of an educated person. Let me illustrate. Any parent learns in breathtaking steps just by being a parent. You should realize that because of you, your parents learned much, often too late. But that kind of learning under the sword does not qualify one as an educated person. Moreover, the learning must be of matters of reality, the real behavior of people and of matter, the real thoughts and reasoning of thinking people, not the pseudo-events so eloquently denounced by Daniel Burstyn, those continued non-events that make up most of what is called news. There is a strong belief among some people that merely naming something solves the problem. I was concerned, one hears, for he acts as if he is two different people. What a relief to find that he is schizophrenic. Or why does the Indian government respond that way? Oh, you see, India is a third world country. Learning for the educated person must be more than becoming aware, more than gaining experience, or more than applying names. The learning must challenge the human's intellect and capacity to comprehend. We should ask what of depth and breadth. Neither the narrow specialist nor the shallow generalist is the ideal. W.H. Auden's description of the 5th century Athenian, who in a bewildered state visits our society, is very apt. I quote, "Yes, says the man from Athens, I can see all the works of a great civilization, but why cannot I meet any civilized persons? I only encounter specialists, artists who know nothing of science, scientists who know nothing of art, philosophers who have no interest in God, priests who are unconcerned with politics, politicians who only know other politicians, unquote. It is sad to report that occasionally one even finds able men and women, competent in their own specialties, who act proud of their having kept clean and innocent of understanding in other areas of study. Perhaps this is only a cloak for hiding their fear of the unknown, but that kind of pride or fear cannot be an attribute of the educated person. However narrow the specialist with no rounding out may seem, even more pitiable is the generalist with no substance. Here is the master of the bull session in the party. In his extreme, he becomes almost like characters in The School for Scandal, able to gossip a little about several subjects, but no more. An evening spent in sharing ignorance with people who do not know and do not think does not produce understanding. Indeed, the application of a course number and credit to a bull session, as has been known to happen, does not give it educational merit. One worries about what he can get away with here. One hears easy statements such as, "Today we all know, and there is an explosion of knowledge." One might carelessly suppose that today everyone is more intelligent than were members of earlier generations. It is well to remind ourselves that where there is increased understanding, it is largely the result of intensive study and effort by a few great characters, and is not a summation of the half-hearted, idle curiosity of the millions. Moreover, for one to be proud that now people know so much, while remaining ignorant oneself, is a foolish position. The student who chooses a major because its requirements are easily met cheats himself of the opportunity to be taken on a rigorous, if short, introduction to the reasoning, thinking, study, techniques, and challenges of one subject. Having avoided the opportunity to learn discipline, he is doomed to superficiality. In a real sense, good education is always both general and special. None of us enjoys having personal ignorance displayed publicly. However, the fear of having others see one's ignorance, if not controlled, can easily prevent one from being an educated person. I like James Clerk Maxwell's statement on this. "A necessary antecedent of learning," he said, "is a clear awareness of ignorance." Maxwell was paraphrasing Socrates, who made the point much earlier. A person who is obsessed by the need to cover up personal ignorance has no chance to become educated. We should ask, is it useful to be educated? Listen to an approximate quotation. I quote, "I took algebra and geometry, never used them, and now my income is 50 times that of the woman who taught those classes. I pay big taxes. Why do the schools waste our hard-earned money teaching junk like that?" That is essentially the statement that appeared in a Letters to the Editor column a few years ago. Some questioners take an expanded view of the problem. Why study English or any language? The Adamic language is all we'll need. Or, law should be useful in the next life if you're in the place where there will be arguments and disagreements and criminals. But I'm sorry. I thought those two were funny, but this next one cuts. "What are you chemists preparing to do? Make thermodynamic studies of the lake of fire and brimstone?" It is sad that so many have spent so much time at schools and university without getting the point. That far beyond all professional or vocational or career aspects of the institutions, there is the assistance, guidance, and encouragement to be educated. And that brings us to the second corollary of the definition. There should be purpose and a sense of responsibility to the learning, at least for the educated Christian. There should be purpose and a sense of responsibility. Here we're not speaking of economic or employment purpose. Your parents and we are all anxious that you be able to get worthwhile work to do, and we expect that almost all of you should do better at your work because of having been here. Indeed, most of you will get positions that you could not have obtained without the experience and degree from the university. However, much of our effort with you here is to help you to be educated. And if that effort is successful, your reward will be far greater than any vocational or economical return alone could be. You'll be a changed person, your life will be different, and you'll have increased ability and opportunity to serve. The Lord said it directly, After stating the limitless breadth of subjects appropriate for our study, he explained the purpose, that ye may be prepared. And as one reads on in the 88th section, one sees that the preparation is to serve one's fellow beings. Is it credible for one to speak of an eternity of progress and then make only a half-hearted effort to learn? The question is asked, isn't it enough to be good? In a limited time, I would try to make a few observations. Joseph Smith, instructed by the greatest characters of scriptural times, burdened with the responsibility of establishing the restored church in the face of appalling difficulties, persecuted, often turned on by people who had been at his side, still responded with remarkable vigor to an inner drive to learn, and how he learned. Read of the school of the prophets, the tutors, and the kinds of subjects that he attacked. After you catch your breath, look at the founder of our university. Brigham Young is often described as pragmatic, and that seems true. But notice how that pragmatism appeared on the subject of learning. He said, "We want our children to grow up intelligently and to walk abreast with the peoples of any nation. God expects us to do it. I have heard intelligent, practical men say it is quite as cheap to keep a good horse as a poor one, or to raise good stock as inferior animals. And is it not quite as cheap to raise good, intelligent children as to rear children in ignorance?" Unquote. If I hadn't told you it was he saying that, you would have known it. I encourage you to look at the other presidents of the church also. It is as if the call to that office ignites an intense drive to learn. President Kimball's comment here last year reaches to the heart of the matter. I quote, "We understand, as few people do, that education is a part of being about our Father's business." Unquote. Isn't it enough to be good? One is reminded of the statement of a distinguished member of this faculty in earlier years, P.A. Christensen, "God himself is limited when men cease to think." We have defined the educated person as one who, by his or her own initiative and discipline, is consciously, vigorously, and continually learning. We have added that the study and learning must be in subjects worthy of the offspring of God, worthy of humans with great potential, and we have added that there must be purpose. Now the question must be faced, are we doing no more than defining an exclusive and elite group? Are we seeking to feed egos by establishing a new class system in which members of the upper class can feel and act out their pretended and snobbish superiority, just as in other class systems? Certainly not. In the first place, there is no barrier to anyone except one's own self. The invitation is to all of us. Any one of us may start immediately, study, learn, and feel the joy of expanding the godlike aspects of our humanness. In addition to the unrestricted invitation, there is built into the nature of learning a remarkable protection against pride. The educated person, actively, consciously, and vigorously learning through his own drive, cannot be egotistical about what he or she knows. Each step that increases understanding reveals a larger area of ignorance than could be seen before. For example, one who has never heard of ancient Greek civilization can have no concept of the extent of his ignorance on that subject. Only as he learns something can he realize how little he knows. One who knows nothing of calculus cannot begin to appreciate how ignorant he is of the possibilities of reasoning, order, logic, and complex problem solving offered by that area of mathematics. One must learn something before he can even recognize his ignorance. Will Durant, writing when he was about 80, said it well. 60 years ago, I knew everything. Now I know nothing. Education is a progressive discovery of our own ignorance. Unquote. You have also heard Newton's statement about having been like a child playing on the beach and having picked up a few pebbles of understanding from the vast shore. In his play, In Good King Charles's Golden Days, Shaw has Newton say to Charles II and George Fox, "I spend my life contemplating the ocean of my ignorance. I once boasted of having picked up a pebble on the endless beach of that ocean. I should have said a grain of sand." These statements by Durant and Newton do not imply that the men became more ignorant, or that they became less confident, or that they knew less. They tell that through a lifetime of learning, each man became increasingly conscious of a world of learning yet to be pursued. The expansion of one's awareness of his ignorance as he learns is a guarantee that the educated person is kept humble about knowledge and understanding. Stop to consider the people you know who know all the answers. They know how the neighbors should rear their children. They know what the president of the church should say on this matter or that. They know what the president of the country should do in this matter, and so on and so on. Isn't it true that the people who know the least about the problem are the most outspoken and the most positive about its solution? If a person is not aware of his own ignorance, he can easily be positive. Pascal's analogy of learning is helpful. In this, the balloon of knowledge grows larger as one learns, thus causing the outer surface of the balloon always to impinge on an ever-increasing area of ignorance. When we recognize that the educated person is kept keenly aware of his expanding consciousness of ignorance and that the door to being educated is open to all of us, we can consider and appreciate Aristotle's response to the question, by how much are educated people different from the uneducated? As much, said Aristotle, as the living are from the dead. His comparison is very apt. Remember that there was no formal and structured school system such as we know. There were no degrees. There were no symbols to confuse one. It wasn't that one had a degree that made him living versus dead. It was that he was learning. The educated person was one who had come to life, who was living. This person was consciously and vigorously learning. The invitation is to every one of us, join the living. Our definition of the educated person includes the point that one's own discipline must cause the learning. A favorite line from the Wisdom of Solomon bears on this. The true beginning of wisdom is the desire for discipline. At our worst, we do not even rise to the level that we desire to discipline ourselves. But when we desire to develop the discipline, there is hope. To learn is hard work. It requires discipline, and there is much drudgery. When I hear someone say that learning is fun, I wonder if that person has never learned or if he's just never had fun. There are moments of excitement in learning. These seem usually to come after long periods of hard work, but it's unfortunate that not all long periods of hard work give any of those periods of excitement. We humans tend to let our minds congregate in areas of trivia, and to protect our minds from the challenge of serious thought. Notice how much more comfortable we feel in the book of Acts, where action leads us on, than in Paul's letters, especially when scriptural arguments are being developed. The commander in Shaw's Man and Superman, in a sad sense, represents all of us when he finds the philosophical discussion between Don Juan and Lucifer too deep for his marble-headed capacity. "This is extremely abstract and metaphysical, Juan," he said. "If you would stick to the concrete and put your discoveries in the form of entertaining anecdotes about your adventures with women, your conversation would be easier to follow." It is impossible to imagine an educated person who does not love the language. The reasons are manifold, but the first, by all odds, is that language is at the heart of our humanness. And our humanness is an essential step in the preparation to become what God would have us be. Without language, would we even be human? In the beginning was the Word. Isn't it interesting that John chose to describe the Son of God in a way that means not only the truth and the way and the direction and the instruction, but also means the language? One is stirred by the thought that John, wise and eloquent, intentionally included multiple meaning. The purposeful meaning for any of us lies in our contact with the language. How anxious one who learns is to tell friends and family of new experiences and new understanding. And as the understanding is of increased complexity and the experience is of greater consequence to our souls, how our need for language explodes. How one yearns for enough competence in the language to say it well. You have reached maturity at a time when the language suffers both neglect and vigorous attack. Those who have rebelled against society or some part of it have often chosen to make their degraded language the first symbol of revolt. But it isn't necessary to revolt to sour the word. Conversations overheard about the campus seem often to consist mostly of, apparently you've listened too. I should hasten to admit that the language lives and evolves and that each minute step of its evolution will irritate someone, and particularly us Victorians. But evolution of the language and its destruction are two different matters. Evolution of the language and its destruction are two different matters. Rapid upheaval of the language by those who never knew and never loved it soon leads to complete and dreadful isolation. Isolation from heritage, isolation from philosophical roots, from faith, from the opportunity to learn well from one's fellow humans, from the ability to tell someone what one knows and feels. We of all people should understand this, for we know of Nephi and Laban, and of God's concern that the religious heritage in written and continuingly understandable form go with that little group of colonists. There is no evidence that the people of Mulek set out to destroy their language, or even that they were especially neglectful. But there is clear evidence of the result of their losing the blessing of a stable language. The great stabilizers of the English language, dating from the early 17th century, appear to have been the King James Bible and Shakespeare. But as generations of English-speaking people mature, having had no serious contact with the Bible and only a forced splash in Julius Caesar in high school, what do we have for stabilizers? Commercial television? When I was an undergraduate, we all read 1984 and Brave New World. We discussed and argued at length the positions of those early futurists. I remember feeling that Huxley peered ahead more clearly than did Orwell, that newspeak described by Orwell was too ludicrous to imagine. In the official language of the regime in 1984, words had the opposite of their ordinary meaning. This language was used for control of the minds of the people. How unbelievable. But this is 1976, 8 years short of 1984. We have read the transcriptions of the White House tapes and have compared them with contemporary public statements by the same men. Newspeak. And if that example seems only a shocking aberration, consider the chatty, disorganized, smudged, meaningless mixture of words that often substitutes for conversation today. Hey, wasn't that, you know, just a fabulous thing? Yeah, I mean, really, tremendous, just far out. How'd that grab you? In the beginning was the Word. For too long and too often, the Word has been used to deceive. Some people in the areas of speech writing, public relations, and advertising have sullied their trades by becoming professional fabricators of images, images that obscure the truth, that deceive. A strangulation of the language is underway by another group, the pompous people. The following quotation should lead us into that gagging bog. I cannot conceive of any scenario in which that could eventuate, unquote. That was said neither by a stand-up comedian nor by Howard Cosell. I'm indebted to ABC and their reporting of the Olympic Games for my awareness of Mr. Cosell. The statement was made by a vice president of the United States when he was asked if he might be a candidate for president. I cannot conceive of any scenario in which that could eventuate. Now, don't be too critical. He could have said, at this point in time, possibility-wise, I am inclined to prioritize that minimally. That reminds me of the time I asked a man a question that could have been answered with yes or no. His answer, my response to your inquiry is affirmative. The aim of many seems to be to mess it up. Cute words are collected by some and used endlessly. Expertise, input, output, feedback, thrust, upgrade, interfacing, throw them in any order. It doesn't make any sense anyway. Interface, interact, know-how, utilize, finalize, actualize, internalize. Listening to someone use such barbarisms nearly forces one to externalize his breakfast. I guess the only part of that that hurts me, that wasn't the most intelligent thing I've said this morning. The numbing effect on the reader or listener is such that he slips past the point of caring that the sentences are meaningless. Your information will be integrated into our own brainstorming. That appeared in a recent memo sent to me. Ordinarily, I have nothing good to say in behalf of speed reading. For if something written is worth reading, it deserves attention and thought, and it's best even savoring. But too often I find myself thinking that since responsibility forces me to plow through non-writing in too many memos, committee documents, their word, not mine, and studies, speed reading is the most that they deserve, while complete and rapid oxidation is the correct treatment, and you chemists would know what that meant. Now let me hasten to add my appreciation to the many on campus. Those busy people who always make the effort to avoid jargon and to get to the point, even taking time to inject little grace. Not every memo or letter or report can be a poem, but it needn't be a garbage dump. When I was in school, my age, we all talk that way. Let me tell you a war story. When I was in school, use and utilize had a subtle but valuable difference in meaning. To utilize meant to make application of something beyond its designed or intended purpose. For example, one on a desert island might, in the emergency, utilize his fountain pen for extracting his companion's appendix. Now, that's clearly an extension of the utility of the fountain pen, and so utilize is the correct word. Today, however, one dare not use the word utilize, for the pseudo-sophisticates, believing that it is a synonym for use, would never apply a one-syllable word when you can sneak in three. The nature of English allows nouns to be made from verbs. Consequently, you and I have heard utilization as a five-syllable offensive substitute for use, the use of something versus its utilization. The language polluted quickly becomes a hindrance to understanding. The noise is high, the signal is weak. You probably will not believe this next, but I have heard that finalize is used officially at some universities. My thesaurus has nearly a half page of words that mean to finish, to end, to complete, to conclude. Good words. Despite the abundance of good words in use, some barbarian with neither love of the language nor appreciation for its value patched together finalize. And it did not stop there. The end has become the finalization. Next, we'll probably encounter the monstrous verb finalizationalize. And you can keep going with it. Now, these examples are only a few fly specks in the filth of mucky language, but you get the idea. The loss will be irreparable if we reach the point that our ties of understanding with the past and the future are severed. Consider those attributes that differentiate us and the animals. Neither our relative hairlessness, accentuated with some of us, nor our use only of the upright position for walking provides meaningful distinction. God's offspring, as distinguished from his creatures, God's offspring, as differentiated from his creatures, have the capability not only of learning from each other and thinking about it, but also of learning from the accumulated understanding, wisdom, and faith of their ancestors. In addition, God's offspring have the responsibility of leaving a heritage of comprehensible knowledge and faith for their descendants. The love of the language that we speak of is not merely some appreciation for the rules that guide us in its use, important as they are. The language at its best functions to reveal the dignity of humans. What would you know of your birthright as a child of God without language? What would one know of the continuity and of the change in the aching efforts of humans to climb to understanding without the language? How could there be love instead of mere lust without the language? Degraded language still allows some functioning in society. One can find the way to a restaurant, buy and sell, send and receive memos, get the television repaired, mention the weather and the election to a neighbor. Much that occupies our time can still be handled with degraded language, but those matters that lift us above the crude and the mundane cannot. George Orwell made an interesting point about the language. A man may take to drink because he feels himself to be a failure and then fail all the more completely because he drinks. It is rather the same thing that is happening to the English language. It becomes ugly and inaccurate because our thoughts are foolish, but the slovenliness of our language makes it easier for us to have foolish thoughts. Then Orwell adds a hopeful note. The point is, for you and me, that the process is reversible. Unquote. It is possible for one who does not love the language to be well-trained, but not to be an educated person. We have so far scarcely mentioned the university and how it fits into the matter of our becoming and staying educated. It should be clear to you that some educated people have not attended the university, and such are not just the Abraham Lincolns of the past. I mentioned having some freshmen in class nearly every year who are educated and who show the interest and drive that should keep them vigorously learning and hence educated. Is there any point in staying at the university? Since you can be educated outside the university, should you stay? Hold on. Don't pack your football and curling iron yet. I chose objects that were not sex-related. The university is excelled by the university. The university is excelled by only one other institution in igniting the fire to be educated. Only one other excels the university, and the university is by all odds the best widely available institution for giving one a solid start in one discipline, the major, along with sufficient exposure to several other areas that one's lifetime of learning can have direction and meaning. It feels redundant to say again what has been proved so many times. It is painfully obvious that one can obtain a degree without becoming an educated person. And that unfortunate truth obtains worldwide. Neither 4 years of punting on the Cam River in Cambridge or of being served parsley at Cannon Center carries a guarantee that one will become educated. But the university offers the opportunity and the encouragement, and you must decide how you will respond. The introduction to music class can be a drudge, with you dragging mental feet complaining at the requirements of the class, or you can wake up, get interested in the subject by meeting the requirements, and then become free by letting that interest carry you beyond the requirements. You can choose to get credit, or you can choose to change your life, still receiving the credit but at an improved grade. That class may be one that will affect your listening ever after. With a little understanding of music, you will crave increased understanding, for you will have seen how much your appreciation and enjoyment grew just from your effort in one class. Or you can get the credit. You can approach the class in the physical sciences, necessary either to prepare for a general education exam or because your major requires it, with fear and resistance because it'll be hard. Or you can immerse yourself in the subject and come to feel the unusual rewards. In no other subjects can one, knowing so little, do so much that is correct and predict accurately the results of so many calculations and experiments. In these subjects, as nowhere else, one can gain an appreciation for order in God's universe and for the possibilities and limitations of human reasoning. Or one can resist and be fearful and miss the whole point. I've reflected recently on my undergraduate years. In each of those 4 years, I had at least one class outside my major that has had profound effect on my life ever since. What a disappointing void would have remained if I had missed taking those classes. By associating with those fine teachers who were educated people, more mature and much wiser than I was introduced to several subjects that I could hardly have hoped to encounter significantly otherwise, and the introduction was sufficient to make it possible for me to maintain reading and study in the areas. I mentioned that the university is excelled by only one institution in the area of igniting, making that first spark of the desire to be educated. It is with joy that I remember the many young men and women whom I have known through their undergraduate years who have changed while here from enrolled bodies to awake and consciously learning students. But another institution has an even better record of making people want to learn than has the university, and we should not be surprised, of course, that it's the home that can excel in creating the desire to be educated. Harry Golden tells in his little book, Only in America, of a practice followed among immigrant Jews in Lower East Side New York when he was growing up there. When a child was presented his first book, one that would be his own, a little ceremony was held in which a drop of honey was placed on the cover of the book. The child knelt, placing his tongue on the honey on the book, so that his first contact with learning would be sweet. One weeps when one realizes that the counterpart in too many homes today is that the poor child may eat his first pizza off the television set. How frequently one observes that the student who has unusual commitment comes from a home where people cared and tried, where books were known and loved, and where ideas, instead of neighbors, were discussed. I'm sorry to say that one cannot always detect whether someone recently met has graduated from a university, but one can soon tell if one is speaking with an educated person. Mark Van Doren points out correctly that nobody who is will ever admit to being educated. This is not, of course, that the person is embarrassed to be educated, but only that he or she is so conscious of so many areas of gross ignorance. Mark Twain saw it clearly. Everybody is ignorant, only on different subjects. But I say one quickly detects when one speaks with an educated person. Matters learned last evening, an idea being pondered and developed, books recently read, an essay just encountered, an argument still going on, a book just purchased to be read tonight, as soon as another is finished. One hears of such from educated people. Over several years, I have spoken I have spoken with many graduating seniors in one program here. With several, there was the pain of learning that not one book had been read since they entered the university, except the required books. By others, a few had been read. But the educated men and women in the program all had books just finished, others being read, and a growing list of books that they could hardly wait to get into. To be an educated person does not carry a set of comfortable guarantees. It will neither cure acne nor remove unwanted weight. It does not promise to remove all ambiguities from life, but the educated person will have increased capacity for living amidst some ambiguity without losing faith in God or man. To be educated does not promise that one will be popular, but neither does it require that one become a social clod. Indeed, the educated person is vastly more interesting to be around. To be educated will enrich one's life and increase one's joy. And joy is the reason that humans are. To be educated will increase one's humanness and one's respect and love for God's offspring. And such love is the second great commandment. To be educated will enlarge one's capacity to serve one's neighbor. And to serve well is the highest calling for a child of God. My suggestion for you and for me is that we get on with the task.